This presentation on the state in the global economy was presented by Stephen Chikaitis, Will Weikart, and Cindy Milstein. It was recorded September 26, 2004, at the Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference in Plainfield, Vermont.
I'm going to try to keep my comments to 15 minutes. So I guess the way that the discussion is framed is kind of like, are states changing in the global context? Like, are states changing to the extent that we need to like update our theory? And even if they aren't changing that much, still do we need to update our theory about how we look at states as anarchists? Because, you know, as anarchists, we, you know, smash the state. We have a particular perspective, not only anti-capitalist, but also anti-statist, right? So that's the part of historically what anarchism has been about. But anyway, so I'm going to start with an anecdote, which kind of frames some questions, because I'm going to build up to some questions and not really try to answer them, and we'll just leave that to the discussion. But I'm going to start with an anecdote. Actually, I was on the phone with my father before the conference, and I said, oh, by the way, this weekend I'm going to be presenting at a conference. And he said, oh yeah, what is it? And I said, Renewing the Anarchist Tradition. He said, oh, that's interesting, you're an anarchist. And I said, well, yeah, I've always kind of been an anarchist, you know, like a social anarchist, not individualist, because he thinks of me as a socialist. But he was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. And, you know, so I was talking about the state or whatever, and he was like, what do you mean by anarchism? And I said something about, like, you know, autonomy and, like, self-determination, decentralization, and his response was funny, because he lives in the South, in the Southeast, and he said, oh, well, that kind of sounds like what, the Confederacy wanted, like states' rights. And I said, well, no, not exactly. I mean, we're against all states, you know. But it actually, I don't want to, like, be dismissive of his comments, because I think he actually raised something that I want to address, you know, when we're talking about, like, autonomy and decentralization and, you know, like communities of voluntary association. But because, and I'll come back to this, but I mean, the point that I'm taking from what he said is actually that, you know, when we invoke terms like autonomy, you know, different groups also want autonomy and have, you know, different goals in mind, different ideas of how they want to use their autonomy, and they're not, those aren't necessarily the same, you know, values that we have as anarchists. So that's something to grapple with. But anyway, so it's a really broad topic. In general, yes, I do think we need to update our theory. And there are some ways that states are changing. But it's hard to generalize, because I don't think all states are behaving in the same way exactly. There are certain states that are relatively hegemonic or dominant in the world system that I think are changing in a lot of ways, but then some states are on, you know, older models that, you know, are operating on ways that aren't necessarily that new. But then I also come from a historical perspective that's not necessarily linear, so it's not like this kind of evolutionary progressive, you know, like there's, you know, history kind of skips back and forth. There's sometimes where, you know, there's residual forms and emergent forms and so forth. So, I mean, in short, like, I just wanted to start by saying, like, what do we mean when we invoke the state, like, today as anarchists? When we say, you know, smash the state, or I'm against the state, anti-statism, whatever. Because, I mean, I tend to think, in general, anarchists, when they invoke the state, they mean any, like, coercive body. Like, ideally, you know, we want a society free of coercion, relatively free of coercion, and free of authority insofar as it can't legitimate itself, those forms of authority. So, but then I also make the point that state is not necessarily the same as nation, which is not necessarily the same as nation state. So, you know, usually nation states are a fairly modern phenomenon, you know. So I mean, we probably, when we say smash the state, we're talking about all of those things. But nations are sometimes not defined by geographical boundaries. You have, like, people invoke things like the hip-hop nation or the, you know, this or that, like, diasporic, you know, communities that aren't geographically isolatable. So, anyway, you know, and in grade school, like in civics class, we learned that generally the state, which, you know, government, is consists of three branches: juridical, legislative, and executive, right? And so basically, I'm just framing it as like the state is a very complex entity, and you know, if state is government, then we're talking about something really broad, you know. And in a lot of ways, we rely on the state in our everyday lives. You know, as much as we want to be against the state, we also, you know, sometimes benefit from the state. And a lot of people actually use states or, you know, courts and things like that as their last line of defense against either, like, colonial regimes or capital or so forth. So sometimes, you know, we use the state even though we don't want to. So... The way I'm coming at, like, thinking about the modern, the contemporary state is through, the people I'm using are primarily, like, Foucault and Deleuze, after him, and also a little bit an essay by this guy, Akil Mbembe, called Necropolitics. But anyway, the reason I'm using these folks to think about state, because even though in their vocabulary they're not necessarily identified as anarchists, but I think that they have a lot to contribute to anarchist theory, and they have a lot in common with us as anarchists. But also, you know, especially in Foucault, there's a long tradition of, like, analysis of sovereignty and subjectivity. And I think any discussion of sovereignty is, you know, implying like states or governments or governmentality, even in Foucault's language. But so anyway, I'm going to try to build up the kind of paradigm I'm using to look at the way that some contemporary states are changing or, you know, evolving is this transition from what's called disciplinary societies to control societies. And Foucault, this is related to Foucault's notion of biopolitics, and all states as biopolitical entities engaging in, like, biopolitical management of, and what that means is, like, management of life itself, with the production and reproduction of life, human and even, you know, non-human life, I would say. But so anyway, Deleuze, who's coming out of Foucault, you know, takes this notion of disciplinary societies, and, you know, which is informed by biopolitics, and is saying, you know, control societies are what are emerging, especially in some of the dominant, like, hegemonic states that are, you know, some people say, like, largely information-based economies, where a lot of, like, material production has left the borders, you know, gone outside or whatever. You know, some people say postmodern or whatever. But, so, I'm going to try to, like, the essay that Deleuze wrote is, that I'm really drawing from is called Postscript on Societies of Control. And it's a short article. It was written, I think, in 90, 89, something like that. But it's a kind of short, dense article. You know, I first read it a few years ago, and just now it's starting to really sink in and make sense to me. So I'm just trying to, like, present this notion of control societies in a very direct and, you know, accessible way. So really, really briefly, I'll try to characterize what, you know, and this is mostly coming out of Deleuze's article, because he's talking about Foucault and picking up Foucault. But so what characterizes a disciplinary society, which is, you know, roughly is like modern, you know, the modern, like, Enlightenment period and afterwards, 18th, 19th century mostly, societies, especially in the West, disciplinary societies are characterized by these enclosures, which are what anarchists largely call institutions. So like family, family, school, military, factory, church, hospital, mental ward, things like that. These are all, you know, fairly discrete institutions that have fairly discrete functions, you know, not absolutely, but they're all, you know, enclosed spaces. And so the life of, you know, the modern subject, citizen, person, or whatever, is characterized by this kind of constant transition between the different enclosures. You know, a family prepares you for school, which prepares you for military, or the factory, or, you know, so it's this constant, like, moving through the different enclosures of society. And they're disciplinary in terms of, you know, kind of channeling your energies towards what's functional, on some degree, like, what's functional for capital. So, I think in Foucault there's an anti-statist critique, and there's an anti-capitalist critique also, but it's not necessarily overt, but I think it's definitely there. So with these disciplinary enclosures, you know, they're sites of power, definitely. You know, power is relatively concentrated and localizable, and, you know, you can identify where, you know, power emanates from these institutions. So where Deleuze, like, picks up from this and is trying to articulate this transition from discipline to control, I mean, what does he mean by control? It's obviously not a new word or concept. People have been talking about social control for a long time. And Deleuze overlaps with that some, but I think he's also adding something new. But so control for Deleuze is this kind of opening out of the disciplinary enclosures. Okay, and like that, at first, this opening out sounds very suspicious, like what? Like prisons are opening their doors and people are running free. That's not exactly what it means. It's more of like the logic of these enclosures is becoming more diffuse, becoming more spread in terms of these institutions that, you know, at one time were relatively discrete in their functions are actually increasingly overlapping in their functions. So the examples, you know, that we're all aware of and the way these play out are, you know, things like the militarization of police, policification of military, increasingly police in schools, military in subways, you know, like all these institutions are, you know, kind of becoming more diffuse. Power is becoming even less locatable in society. So, you know, there's lots of examples in terms of prescription drugs, you know, like over medication of populations, things like that. What some people who just study the prison industrial complex talk about the collateral consequences of incarceration. I take this as an example. What that means is, like, you know, if you've been incarcerated, even when you're free, like released out of prison, there are all these things that follow you around and continue to, like, disenfranchise you, like, specifically, like, not being able to vote, becoming ineligible for certain, you know, public assistance programs. All these things are collateral consequences of incarceration. So even though you're, like, nominally free, not in prison, a certain aspect of, you know, that unfreedom of the prison is following you. And even in material ways, like the, you know, ankle bracelets that monitor you, your movement when you're on parole, or probation, rather. So this is kind of, I'm characterizing as part of, you know, this is how control plays out. It's more diffuse, less localizable. I think it also raises questions of how and why people are complicit in their own subjugation. You know, people policing each other, kind of like adopting the, you know, the logic or the kind of mentality of a cop, you know, things like that. But also another big characteristic of control societies for Deleuze is the importance of, you know, networks and information. Like, we're always, increasingly, it's hard not to be part of these networks that are constantly tracking our movement, and producing information about us, not individually us, but populations. You know, so you know, there's a lot of continuity between biopolitics in Foucault and the transition, you know, which is kind of like disciplinary, into control. It's kind of an intensification. It's not necessarily different. It's not necessarily more overtly oppressive. I think it's more insidious, and that it's harder to see where power is. And I don't know if people accept that, but so what else? I guess just bringing back my example that I started with, my discussion with my father over the phone about autonomy, is I want to raise some questions, you know, around, you know, the point that he made, you know, implicitly, that there are, you know, other groups that also want autonomy and want to form communities of voluntary association who don't necessarily share the same values that we. And so how does that work in terms of people's movement between different communities? Because we all have, like, maybe I'm vegetarian, and I want to be part of the vegetarian community. But I'm also, you know, I have a whole list of values or whatever, or habits and things, that put me, you know, varyingly in some communities, and then outside those communities, and in other communities. You know, so we're never just part of, like, one community of people that share all of our values, right? So, I mean, for me, this just raises questions of autonomy and small, like, community-based, autonomous, you know, groupings, decentralization, local, relatively small. But how do these, you know, ideally autonomous communities, how do they interact with each other? Because presumably we're not positing some kind of, like, isolationist fantasy that, you know, there'll be these, like, communities geographically separated that won't come in contact. Of course, there'll be, like, some communities that don't share our values that are hostile, and, you know, so, but also, you know, how do these small communities, autonomous communities, if we could actually reach that point, how do they avoid the kind of, like, reemergence of states, like small, very small s states, or, you know, what Foucault talked about, like, governmentality, which is, like, not as hard and, like, clear-cut as government, per se, but it's kind of that, like, diffusion of the governmental kind of mentality, you know, policing each other, things like that. How, how do we avoid, like, reproducing coercive structures in these autonomous communities, and try to prevent the reemergence of small states? I guess that's all I have to say right now.
I want to say I'm really appreciative that Will talked about how the changes in the state aren't something that's smooth, and that it's so, in 10 or 15 minutes speaking, I should keep track of my time, that this, I'm going to have to make a lot of generalizations in a sense, and it isn't happening everywhere, but I'm really appreciative. I also agree that things, there's discontinuities and changes don't happen simultaneously everywhere, but at the same time, I think similar to the way Marx was able to look at economic structures and come out of those and come up with a critique of how social relationships are formed under capitalism, I think you can do the same thing with the state, which hasn't been done. There needs to be a book called The State, in the same way that Marx did Capital, that understands that there's certain logics to what happens with shifts in state craft. And for me, I think right now we're going through one of those very big transitional points. So some of the states that are changing more dramatically are pointing to the possibility of where other states will probably be compelled to go. I also want to just mention, just before I start speaking, I really want to make a distinction between the state or statecraft and government. I understand the state to be a form of government, a form of governance, in the way that capitalism is a form of producing things, distributing things, and consuming things, and both form overlapping but also distinct social relationships that interrelate with each other now, so much so that it's hard to separate the two. But I think it's important to separate out how the state becomes different than capital as well, because I think they offer different ways that we need to struggle against at the same time. But so for me, the project is dismantling the social relationship that we understand of statecraft right now in order to figure out what a different form of governance would be. In other words, how we'd make decisions. So that's what I'm concerned about. I also want to just to refer to Marx. I sort of want to apply the concept of alienation into the realm of politics or governance, where in a sense we become so alienated from ourselves that the state, to me, has basically taken away our ability to be political and alienated us from the making of decisions in the world. In the sense that it's also, capitalism alienates us from the things that we make. We don't recognize ourselves in those. We don't recognize ourselves in the decisions that get produced in society right now, the decisions that are imposed. And the last sort of preface is, for me, a lot of the shifts that have been going on in the state, I don't really know when to date this, because I also think this becomes, it's hard to say, okay, now there's a huge distinct shift in statecraft. But a lot of what I think is happening probably begins to emerge after the post-war era, where when people are trying to figure out what the hell went wrong in terms of fascism and Nazism, different forms of fascism and Nazism, and how to sort of rebuild states in the wake of that, the project, not our project, but other people's project, and also at the same time, separate but overlapping shifts over time in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, culturally, colonial struggles, technological changes, economic changes that are distinct but relate to each other, make coincidentally overlap, and also change each other. So I find it also hard to separate out the state and then say, well, you know, the state is this because of technology or because of economics. They all have changes that happen. They help change other things in each other, but they relate to each other. So I have a hard time separating them out, but I will today, for the sake of actually making an argument about what's happening with the state. And then a distinct turning point for me in the state is huge shifts in capitalism in the 1970s, which facilitate and almost compel the state to make the state, or various large states, especially the United States, and Europe and other major Asian countries, to make shifts starting in the 80s. So sort of the Reagan era in the United States, which in a large way are responses to shifts in economic and technological changes. And then 89, when actually existing communism collapses, and suddenly you come to another crisis point where statecraft has to understand how to, if your project is want to build states, you need to figure out what's going to replace what had happened in the Eastern Bloc countries after 89. Okay. The other preface I want to make is, I think traditionally states, since the rise of states, have often been, or how political philosophers have understood states, and Will had talked about this as the three branches of government, legislative, administrative, and the judicial branch. And more, I think those three areas might be breaking down in terms of how political philosophers have understood what is completely fundamental to the role of the state. It does those three things. More and more, I think it becomes unclear that the state alone does the legislative, and I'm not going to really talk about that today, but I think that's being done more and more with shifting configuration of transnational corporations, supranational institutions above the state, or dealing from the state, regional economic blocs, networks of states, that legislation doesn't just happen in Washington, D.C., in a state house, in one place. So that has to be rethought. The second category, administration, who's going to then do those things that get decided, which again has traditionally been the bureaucracy of one state. I think largely that's being more and more left to civil society, which is supposedly us, volunteerism. A lot of us actually fill in on what the state used to do with our wonderful projects, like, you know, giving out books or food or things like that, but we're in a sense filling in on some of the things the state used to do, as are large NGOs, the UN, and the ultra-rich and the ultra-elite, global elites through the World Economic Forum and World Social Forum. People that basically want to manage how we're going to feed people, deal with healthcare issues, poverty, pollution, etc. And the branch I really want to focus in on, whatever the last 10 or 12 minutes I have left here, is the judicial branch. And I think this is more and more what the state is going to be able to really focus in and hone on in, and that more and more this function of what's the third sort of branch of governance under the modern state, I think, is becoming more and more important. And what the state really is able to do, almost less without being hindered or having to be networked in with these other groups, is the interpretation of law and its enforcement. Okay, so that's what I want to focus on. The last thing I want to say on that as a caveat is maybe the fourth branch is us. I don't like when we get collapsed into civil society, but all the movements that are happening globally right now is as kind of weak as they seem, really, in terms of shifting social relationships. There are thousands and thousands of social movements that are overlapping, understanding themselves, working together or not. And there's also thousands of reactionary social movements right now at the same time emerging. And those, I think, are maybe a fourth power in both for positive and negative, or also marginalized purposes. So it's difficult, I think, to understand the changing nature of statecraft or statecraft forms of governance right now. And I just want to offer some tentative thoughts, or maybe on, I didn't number this properly, so maybe six or seven areas where I think we can see in the judicial branch of governance how the state's functions or roles or what its ability to operate in the world are changing. I think this is in flux, and these are tentative thoughts. I also want to say it's very difficult in a time period where there's such dramatic, rapid change going on for us to describe what's happening right now. And so we maybe can offer a point to where things look like they're going. So that's what I'm going to do right now. So first, what seems to be happening is a shift in, and Will had touched on this, a shift from the state as being a clear chain of command and control and a center to power, hierarchical political power, to more and more masked or unclear, flexible networks of command and control. Networks of hierarchical power that have to work together, but are also harder and harder to figure out where they are, and that are able to be mobile and change when they need to, be very, very flexible. And a person I've really been influenced by in the last year, Manuel Castells' work, he talks about this as the network state, moving toward network state, where the state itself has to be working with other states, but the real powers, the real states that become powerful, are those that control the links between the networks. So you can be part of a network, and that's not where the power lies. It's when you have the ability to broker the power between networks of different states doing things, which is why something like the United States, when you think about the number of networks the United States belongs to in terms of control and command around the world, and its ability to be flexible and shift and drop out of those different networks and go back in when it doesn't, the U.S. government, for instance, to use that as an example. When it doesn't like the UN, it drops out of that network, for instance, or it's upset with the European Union, or et cetera, it drops out. But it has the ability to call the shots between a lot of the networks of what's happening, and that's where the control lies. The second shift, I think, in the state is a shift, Will talked about this, is when the state has largely moved toward more of a nation-state structure. Increasingly, I think the nation is being disconnected from the state, and there's actually an antagonism between the two, and both are becoming deterritorialized. And they both, in a sense, are seeking forms of global power and control. So for me, this becomes a twofold thing. One is you have nationalisms without and not wanting states. They're centered around often fabricated global sense of what a nation means in relation to ethnicity or religion. So maybe Al-Qaeda is an example of understanding themselves as their project as bringing about some form of, you know, very fabricated, rewritten, perverted and really ugly form of a fundamentalist, I don't even like to call it religion in a way, but how they understand, in a sense, it's a nation that would operate outside of any territorial bounds, outside of how we've understood states operate, but is seeking some kind of nationalism that connects people around the world based on a form of what they understand a religion to be or a set of values. Some of these nationalisms can be good in a sense. Two, if we, to some degree, is a sense of an anti-capitalist movement, in a sense, I don't want to use the term nationalism here very loosely, but some sense of shared identity that we're trying to strive for, too, that's delinked from states. Okay, and on the other side, but mostly I think these are pretty ugly nationalisms, they're not seeking states, they're seeking some kind of global control around a shared identity, religion, ethnicity. The other is a state without and not wanting nationalisms, centered around often also generally fabricated but amorphous ideas of patriotism, for instance, the United States. There isn't any kind of shared, you know, race, gender, sexuality, religion in the United States, but somehow there's this weird thing that the American flag is everywhere, and that's what binds us together, this odd sense of that's what the state is about, and delinked from any sense of sort of real identity. So separating state from nation. The other shift in the state that leads to is it breaks down the state as a monopoly of violence, I think, which is traditionally what's been anarchists, one of the biggest critiques that anarchists have had of the state is that the state has a monopoly on violence, and that's one of the fundamental reasons we oppose the state. And I think this is being more and more called into question. That the state doesn't have a monopoly on violence. On September 11th showed that there's, you know, small number of people can have a huge impact on geopolitical, economic, cultural shifts that normally states in the past have had the control of. And thus that points to a shift from the state's ability to do one of its traditional functions, which has been to protect and I'm saying this in quote marks because obviously most of us don't feel protected under the state, to its attempt now to preempt. So instead of, in a sense, what happens is now the state moves into the realm of the judicial, of enforcement, where might is truly right, and in a sense the early bird has power. Whoever gets to someplace first before that thing has even happened, and we don't even know what that thing is, they're going to have the power, that statist entity. It implies there's nothing to protect anymore, no civil liberties, nothing that we would bat, no civil human rights, etc., that the state is going in to preempt some alleged infraction against something, but not to protect us from something that's tangible. Not that I'm arguing that the state ever did that in a lot of ways, but that was its claim before. It was protecting my body or my civil rights, or etc. And now it wants to preempt that, including here internally, for instance, when, to use an example from demonstrations, very much a shift in the last 4 or 5 years of preemptive arrests, for instance, before we've even thought about what we're going to do or where we're going to do it, oftentimes, or with any notion of what we're going to do, it isn't about protecting our civil liberties, it's just shutting down something that might have happened before we've even had really even done anything. That leads, in a sense, so what I think this also points to is a turn from a sense of the state having its power being through militarism to its power being through police actions and policing. That we're not fighting wars anymore, we're fighting constantly the ability to preempt through police actions, through policing of people, surveillance, all sorts of forms of control that look more and more like policing than militarism. Which again makes anarchists have to rethink their position, because traditionally anarchists have been very opposed to, including a banner I'm part, my collective name, neither militarism nor capitalism, as we focused on militarism, but in a sense I think there's a shift us needing to focus on how militarism itself has become more policing. And this policing and this idea of preemption instead of protection is all done in the name, this is the second to last point on how I think the state is changing, all done in the name of a shift in what values the state is claiming it's seeking to use its preemptive power. In the sense before, the state was using this idea of it is protecting us for the purpose of liberty and justice, and there's some system that if liberty and justice are violated, the state then has some system of punishment. And now we're shifting to a world where the state is making, or states are making claims that they're doing this in the name of freedom and democracy, where freedom becomes the idea of basically free markets, and democracy becomes the idea of being able to go in there and use that as a cover to be able to implement free markets. And so we move toward more of a control society, which I agree with Will too, where you move instead of actually the idea that the state says, you've done something and now you violated someone's civil liberties, now you're going to be punished for something specific. Now you haven't done anything yet, you're not even sure what you may have been about to do. The state's going to preempt that from happening and figure out ways to create control all the time. In a sense, more and more policing our whole lives, creating almost constant control, at the same time in the name of freedom. And those two things end up both perverting what we understand freedom to be and with control. So in a sense, we have to, I hope, delink freedom from control and reclaim those two values. But lastly, the last shift I think that's happening in statecraft is a shift from a sense, and again, I'm not trying to advocate that the state has ever done this, but I think this is one of the most powerful arguments you could make for one of what was, quote, progressive about the states at a certain time in history, was a shift from a sense of rule of law or laws and limits on absolutism, which was a lot of the claim of the state, to a world of complete, the state operating lawless, in a state of lawlessness and a state of limitlessness. Territorially, and again, so that's why I really want to point to the judicial branch, is the state suddenly, especially the United States, is suddenly saying that in a sense it doesn't have to abide by laws and it has unlimited ability to do whatever it wants in this, we can preempt anything that we think is about to happen based on nothing through police actions, and in the name of freedom and democracy, which is ultimately about controlling us. So I just want to end with perhaps where do we begin to see these? And I made a lot of broad generalizations. I think perhaps the best place we can sort of begin to see what the new ugly outlines of a statecraft or might look like are emerging in places like Guantanamo Bay. And I want to just, for the last 5 minutes, turn to one of my favorite political philosophers, German-Jewish Hannah Arendt, political philosopher, in a book, Origins of Totalitarianism, the last section in that book, where she looks at her understanding. I don't like her term totalitarianism, but the book is incredibly provocative, and the last chapter remains incredibly fresh at this point. And she tried to understand what a totalizing what totalizing social systems look like in the aftermath of Nazi Germany, and I think we now need to do that in the aftermath of the collapse of the Eastern Bloc and with globalization. What she thought at that time was that concentration camps were, quote, the true central institution of totalitarian organizational power and, quote, the guiding social ideal of total domination in general. For her, totalizing systems like Nazi Germany attempted to openly claim world domination, but secretly in the concentration camps, and this is another quote from her, they were, quote, creating laboratories in the experiment of total domination. And her notion was that in those laboratories, they wanted to verify that with unlimited control and power, quote, everything is possible. In her mind, to do such experimentation, you needed to create a place of the living dead, because total domination is only possible if humans are reduced to mere things, in a sense, something less than even sort of animals, treating people as if they never existed and making them disappear. So she makes a claim that life and death are equally obstructed. We don't have the right to live and we don't have the right to die. We're sort of completely erased. And how she understood this happening in the concentration camp was it involved first the experiment in the concentration camp, was first destroying the legal person, your rights, your legal protections, any kind of citizenship. Again, we can question all these categories, but she said this is what was happening. And in the camp, the essential principle was the arbitrary selection of victims, thereby implying that all of society was a potential victim. You didn't have to do anything, but you could end up being controlled, dominated socially. So break down any sense of the idea that you have to actually do something to be controlled and dominated. The second stage was to destroy the moral or the ethical person, that we have no ability to distinguish right from wrong in the world anymore. And the third was to destroy people's selfhood, again, our ability to act, to resist, to even kill ourselves. Life and death sort of becomes meaningless. Now, she didn't understand the concentration. Her argument wasn't that the concentration camp was going to be spread out and become society, but that in those camps, that was a central institution where, behind sort of closed doors, the state could experiment in how methods of domination that it could bring out to society, not to make society death camps or concentration camps, but to use some of to experiment outside of sort of public eyes to experiment how you could break humans down. I think this is clearly happening in places like Guantanamo Bay now, where the state, in a place of utter deterritorialization, no sense of what's right or wrong, no lawlessness, no way of even the silliest things we've asked for in the past, which are utterly meaningless too, is the right to an attorney, the right to kind of what you've done, the right to know what you're accused of. None of these things happen in this place, and we don't really even know what's happening in this place. And in a sense, it isn't necessarily, they could be hurting people physically, but in a sense, what they're also doing is breaking people down completely psychically. Breaking someone down is what it even means to be human. You have no sense of where you are, when you'll get out, what you've done. And that, in a sense, starts bringing that out to all of us in society as that could become what society could look like. The last thing I want to say about Guantanamo Bay is it's not just a United States project. There are people from 42 countries there. Very few other states have made a hell of a lot of complaints about their nationals in Guantanamo Bay, and I think they're just as happy to see that experiment in social control and what it could look like to dominate go on. So even if they're not the ones doing the guarding or, you know, the humiliation or calling the shots in there, they're all really, I think, ultimately excited about what that laboratory in social control is looking like and what it will come up with and how that can be brought up to society. The methods, again, I'm not saying that all society is going to become Guantanamo Bay. Okay, so I'll just end up on, I also have to hope that there's some imperatives to this that statecraft can't control, that they can never come up with a solid method of social domination. It didn't succeed, and the Nazis were not able to come up with a 100% guarantee of social domination. And so for us, I just want to end up with, I think we need to come up with forms of being non-alienated from the political making of our own world. We have to reclaim what it would mean to have a non-alienated relationship to making decisions about society. And to go back to sort of Arendt at this point, her three ways of breaking us down, is I think we need to rethink what it means to reclaim what it means to be human, our selfhood, our subjectivity. We need to start acting ethically, and anarchists have been very good at this, to contest new forms of government, to bring back the moral ability to say things are right and wrong. And lastly, we have to bring back what she talks about, destroying the legal personhood, that you need rights and protections and citizenship. I don't think that's our project. I think we have to more and more bring back what a concept of just that there needs to be protections in forms of self-governance. People need to have human rights, and people need to have the ability to have basic needs, and et cetera. But those don't need to reside in new forms of states. We need to come up with something that looks like forms of non-governance forms of ways of understanding how we make.
What I want to do here is not present a completely, you know, worked out statement, because, but just a few thoughts I want to just disperse in debate. And this is coming out of my training is as a sociologist, and I was doing work on global citizenship, and I realized, you know, was realizing that sociology in particular is so tied with particular assumptions about how politics work, that there are all these different forms of political actor and corporation and community that in mainstream sociology models just don't exist because they can't fit. So it's like, well, they're not real. So just thinking about, like, well, why is that? And so what I'm going to do is talk about, you know, the question here is, what is the changing role of the state in relation to, in state power relation to, flows of global capital? And I think the book goes said in various forms. I think this is really important because the nature of sovereignty itself is transforming itself and committing itself in relation to global capital. And there was a period about the mid-90s, when a lot of social theory seemed to have this impression that globalization was going to just, like, do away with the state, it was going to, like, wither away, and that global capital would somehow magically smash the state power for us. That was kind of silly. But it was kind of fun to read because for a second it actually sounded like a bunch of social scientists were actually anarchists, but that wasn't really true. It's also interesting because from 92 to 94 is actually when Empire was written. So when you're trying to, like, think of or get to put it in that context of, like, you know, what was happening at that point. And I think what has been happening is not a decline of sovereignty, but how sovereignty is being re-territorialized and transformed. And reordering, how state power operates, and which is, this is you know, kind of pressing, because state power, as you indicated, is not necessarily just operating through the strictly formal means, but is also in forms of private security companies, drug tests, random frisks, all these different diffuse means, which even if they aren't recognized as official parts of state power, in fact are. And so, again, if we want to, you know, subvert, smash, or you can just squish the state, you know, we've got to know, you know, what is it? So, we're going to make perhaps some of a bizarre statement that I think could guide how to look at this. The state does not exist. And I feel a bit silly saying this because I've been in court for a week, and it's pretty obvious that, you know, the government is making my body have to do certain things, or else bad shit's gonna happen. But what I want to say is not that government power and systems control don't exist, because they clearly do, and are permeating many more aspects of our lives constantly. But I think that Eric is talking about the state as if it's a single, coherent, unified, totalizing process, which it's not. And if we talk about the state as one single subject, this tends to reify, mystify, and fetishize the working of state power itself, and to imbue it with a form of unity that it doesn't actually have. So I want to talk about the state neither as, you know, an autonomous realm object of something where politics happens, which is sort of how Weber talks about the state, nor as sort of like the executive committee that, you know, reflects class relations, which is the general Marxist take on it, nor as a strictly object of ideology, which is sort of, I guess, that's coming out of like Althusser. But what I want to talk about the state here is both the material processes, regulations, forms of coordination, control work in the physical world, as well as the ideological, philosophical, and political concepts which construct and attempt to, you know, make these things a unified, coherent whole and call this, you know, the state. And it's these two things working together, both, you know, the process of domination and the ideas which then connect them. And then, so, then you're talking about the idea of the state, the construction of the state out of these disparate and contradictory practices. And in some ways, the idea of the state is just as much a part of domination as the processes of control of themselves. this is interesting to think about, because we talk about, you know, a historical evolution of government. It's not like, you know, one day someone sat down and said, I want to invent the state. No, that never happened. But it was more a process of, feudal lords and barons trying to extract, you know, land and loyalty and capital out of people, generally to conduct wars. And then these processes sort of ossified into bureaucracy and ways to get these done more efficiently, And then it's funny because as that occurred, you know, instead of having the sort of open relation between, you know, here is the ruler and just as the subject, then was the invention of the people. So all of a sudden, people were then used to justify, you know, and create this gloss over how power was working. And the problem is that if we discuss the state as a unified, you know, subject and object, we're sort of prevented from seeing the contradictions, holes, and openings in how power is working. Because if it's just one thing, there's just this one giant block which is sort of like, you know, ruling and dominating everything, it's much harder to see places where it's falling apart or contradicting itself, working against itself. And so I think this is kind of, you know, a big mistake to make, because if we want to talk about, you know, finding ways, you know, to build autonomy, to create realms of freedom, we need to be able to appreciate places where like it exists that we don't see. And so the reason I'm getting into this is because if you're talking about the transformation of state power in relation to the global economy, and just transformation of state power itself, a lot of these changes aren't, you know, they're not like they're being, you know, codified and declared formally, you know, like some document you can go in and see how it works. But through spaces outside of official state bounds, outside of the realm of law, which are transforming the nature of power itself, which is, I think, sort of where you were ending. You know, going back to, you know, Nazi Germany, the actual changes in law, which was enabled the death camps, like, it wasn't like they were all put in law. There was just, like, I think, like maybe like two little changes in law which just changed the nature of police power. And then all of a sudden, this enabled massive transformation of state power without actually being codified as such, you know, because it was all very, you know, it wasn't like they were, you know, they were like a declaration of we're going to do this. Okay, so in particular, like these sort of spaces where the rule of law is suspended, for instance, Guantanamo Bay, Abu Ghraib, or particularly included in laws such as Patriot 1 or 2, it creates zones not covered by national or international law, where there's a vast expansion of unchecked executive and sovereign power, which are basically created through ideas around a state of emergency, or basically, like, these are, you know, it's usually always kind of, these are only temporary powers, but temporary powers, you know, have a way of becoming less than temporary, they keep going. And so these zones of spaces which are somehow outside of law, outside of state power, places where basically anything can occur, not because it's like, you know, officially set upon, more because just based upon, you know, like, I guess you say the goodwill of the captors, which is a really sketchy thing to rely upon. But these spaces outside of law, at the same time, create forms of power and subjugation that are captured within law and transform how law operates itself. And so if we're trying to understand the changing nature of how state power is operating in the global economy, it's really hard to do this if we're continuing to think that the state is one thing, because it's not. I mean, one instance is, I think this happened a few months ago, a bunch of people in Congress had realized that Chapter 11 of NAFTA had given various corporations the power to sue the U.S. and overturn laws, and they said, we didn't know this happened, which was really funny because they signed the damn law. But it's funny because if you're thinking of this, you know, of a state as one thing, things like this wouldn't make any sense, because, well, if government power is one thing, well, why is it doing something that's undermining itself and all this, like, why would it do that? But if you're coming at it from, like, seeing how there are different processes of power which can work in conflicting and contradictory ways, it's a lot easier to see, you know, and explain why these things are happening. And so, just I'll be very short just to conclude so we can get on discussion, is if we want to be able to open up spaces of possibility and autonomy, and to also to recognize how processes of domination and control are working, it's really difficult to do this effectively if we're seeing state power in the state as one thing, when in fact it's not really many more smaller pieces and things contradict themselves. Oh, I'm sorry. Finis.